Good morning. Welcome to the June 9th, 2026 meeting of the Colorado River Basin Regional Water Quality Control Board. For everyone joining us in the meeting room, please turn off or silence your cell phones. This meeting is being webcast and recorded, so please speak clearly. This meeting is being conducted in a physical location and is also available via remote access. For people who only want to listen or watch the meeting, the board's customary webcast is available. For those in the Zoom meeting, you will be muted with your cameras off until it's your turn to speak. The host will then unmute you and ask you to turn on your camera if you have one. When you are done speaking, the board members will have completed asking questions. You will be placed on mute and your camera turned off. You can remain in the Zoom meeting until the completion of your item, and then you may choose to exit the meeting or continue. Let's say Pledge of Allegiance. Board member Music, can you lead us?
Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Before we continue, I would like to ask the clerk to do roll call.
Chair Perez.
Present.
Vice Chair Gonzalez.
Good morning. Present.
Board Member Beltran.
Present.
Board Member Music.
Present.
Board Member Satin.
Present.
Board Member Wright.
Here.
Madam Chair, we have a quorum.
Thank you. For the purpose of this public meeting, the purpose of this public meeting is for the regional board members to obtain testimony and information from concerned and affected parties within the Colorado River Basin region regarding water quality issues. Item number two, public forum. We welcome hearing from the public at this time. Any person wishing to speak should have submitted a speaker request as described in the agenda instructions for those items listed on today's agenda. You will make your comments at the time of the item being considered. If you wish to speak on an item that is not on the agenda, you may speak now during the public forum. Comments generally will be limited to 3 minutes. The board clerk can now identify the speakers who have submitted speaker cards for the public forum.
We do not have any.
Thank you. Okay, we are now moving to agenda number three, which is the review and approval of the minutes from the board's prior meeting on May 12th. Does any board member have comments or wish to propose changes to the minutes?
Move to approve.
May I have a motion?
Is that a motion? I'll second.
Okay. Motion, second, and individually. Can we have a poll, please?
Chair Perez.
Aye.
Vice Chair Gonzalez.
Aye.
Board Member Beltran.
Aye.
Board Member Music.
Aye.
Board Member Satin.
Aye.
Board Member Wright.
Aye.
The motion carries.
Thank you. For item number four, the board will now hear an update from Laurel Firestone, our liaison to the State Water Resources Control Board.
Great. Hello. Whoops.
Good morning.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. Sorry. Good to see you all. I have a few updates. One, I wanted to thank folks that participated in the Water Quality Coordinating Committee meeting in May. If folks are interested in seeing some of the sessions, if they missed it, the meeting recordings are available on the webpage. There are some good sessions on funding, HABs, many other things. Just it's a great opportunity. So thanks to everyone that participated. Also want to thank folks that participated, especially our executive officer and Emma, who participated in the Salt and Sea workshop that we held. It was a good workshop, and hopefully in future years it will be back down in the valley or near the Salt and Sea. We have workshops also coming up on Mono Lake. another Salton Sea, another Salton Lake that is, well, we actually, that we held one on June 4th and we have another one coming up on June 25th. We held a really great info session workshop on the State Board's Racial Equity Action Plan. So this was a three-year action plan. We're coming to the end of that three-year cycle. And so it was a really great overview of the progress that we've made. And there's an interactive report available online. And then this summer, we're going to be starting that public process to develop our next three-year action plan to implement our racial equity resolution. So I encourage folks, there is the recording available, but there's also just a really great interactive report. It covers every division at the State Board and gives some overview, a little bit of the work going on at the regions. Let's see, we have, we've been doing a lot on Bay Delta work. We've issued a draft decision and draft permit for the Sites Reservoir project and are conducting hearings really most days of this month on the Delta Conveyance Project. We are going to be holding a workshop on next week on the 16th on the Agricultural Expert Panel's report. So encourage folks that are interested in that to tune in. This is going to be a presentation of a final report from the Ag Expert Panel. It's particularly focused on nitrate impacts to groundwater metrics, incentivizing opportunities to incentivize regenerative and organic practices, but also looking at small farm and diverse farms and just recognizing some of the diversity in the state. So this will be an overview of that report. And then I know we'll be having future discussions and actions around how to implement what we've learned from that panel. We had a good overview of implementation of the Conservation as a Way of Life water efficiency standards. Encourage folks to go back if they're really interested and watch. There was a really good overview, a lot of compliance and progress, I think a new technical assistance program that's helping systems be able to comply with that, in partnership with some associations. We're at this upcoming June 16th meeting, we're going to have an informational item on constituents of emerging concern, that our overall program around constituents of emerging concern, as well as some particular contaminants, and encourage folks that are interested to join in on the 16th for that. We'll also be on that day considering an aquifer exemption for the Kern River oil field in Kern County. Let's see, the Department of Transportation's annual update to their TMDL compliance plan. Our comments were, they've submitted their annual report, and comments were due June 8th to be considered. We're considering a number of water rights certifications around hydroelectric projects, let's see if there's, and then I think lastly, we're holding Continuing to hold meetings with stakeholders around fees. So this is our annual fee setting process around water quality, water rights, drinking water, all of those fees. Since our programs are fee funded, we have to do that annually. And I think with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Does anyone have any questions?
Yeah, thanks. Good morning, Laurel.
I can't hear if somebody is talking.
I'm sorry. Good morning.
Okay. Hi. Good morning.
I'm fine. How are you?
Great.
But, you know, the as part of the water future water supply, we were looking at desalination, which takes a lot of power to operate. And now we have these data centers, and we know we have a housing shortage. How are is the state going to prioritize, you know, the power situation, so we ensure we have enough power to assist us to enhancing our future water supply?
Yes, that is a big question. I will say, you know, as many things are, it's a little bit siloed. There are processes through the Energy Commission. There's an interagency group that looks at grid reliability and energy reliability through those agencies. It's not specific to water, that's just statewide demands. And then I will say, in terms of water supply, you know, locally, each water supplier has to do their, urban water suppliers have to do their water supply 5-year plans for looking at water supply, as well as, and overall as a state, we have our the sort of revamped state water plan that we're doing, where we have a targeted amount of additional or replacement supply given climate change, that we're looking at how we bring together all the different strategies like desal water recycling, stormwater, and other conveyance, and of course conservation as ways of ensuring that we have adequate water supply. But, you know, a lot of this is very fragmented, and each individual jurisdiction needs to be looking at this for their own, you know, energy and water supply management needs. So I think it's a good question, emerging issue for sure. Oh, and one last thing is, we are considering or doing scoping around an update to the desal part of the ocean plan policy within the ocean plan, to just help identify how to allow for streamlining of appropriate, I would say streamlining, but like a clear pathway for appropriate desal, that so that there's clarity on how permitting could occur and how to enable sort of a smoother permitting process than what we've done in the past. But, you know, desal still remains a pretty small portion of the overall water supply, even as we look forward. So I think increasingly, as you said, there's energy demands that and prices of energy are continuing to go up. So it's a major issue.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thanks. Great to see you all. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
The board will not consider items on the uncontested calendar. Excuse me. All items appearing under the uncontested item calendars are acted upon by the board in one motion without discussion. There is one item on today's uncontested calendar. This is item number 5, which is a waste discharge requirement order and corresponding monitoring and reporting program for Cal Energy Operating Corporation. Desert Valley Monofill Expansion Project, located in Imperial County. This is the second of two permits that the board is issuing. The previous one, which was adopted last month, prescribes requirements for discharges of solid waste to waste management units under Title 27 of California Code of Regulations. This one prescribes requirements, discharges of drench or fill material for waters of the state. Regarding the uncontested calendar, does any board member wish to remove an item from this calendar? Thank you. Can I get a motion on the uncontested item?
So moved.
Second?
I'll second.
Madam Clerk, may we have the roll call?
Chair Perez?
Aye.
Vice Chair Gonzalez?
Aye.
Board Member Beltran?
Aye.
Board Member Music?
Aye.
Board Member Satin?
Aye.
Board Member Wright?
Oh, aye.
Motion carries.
Thank you. Proceeding now to the contested and discussion of calendar item adoptions, there is one item on the contested calendar today, agenda item number 6, which is waste discharge requirements, order and monitoring and reporting program for Ormat Nevada, Inc., Heber 1 and Heber 1 startup pits in Imperial County. I am now opening up the hearing on agenda item 6, which is the waste discharge requirements, order monitoring reporting program for the startup pits in Ormat, Nevada, Inc., Heber's 1 and 2, Heber Geothermal Facilities in Imperial County. We have no speakers on this one. I will not administer the oath to all persons intending to speak on this item. Raise your right hand and take the following oath. Do you swear or affirm that the testimony you're about to give is the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth under penalty of perjury? If so, say I do. Please state your name, affiliation, whether you have taken the oath before testifying.
Hello. Okay. Good morning, Chair Perez, members of the board, members of the public. My name is Brianna Allen. I am an engineering geologist in the land disposal unit. Today, I'll be presenting on the Heber 1 and Heber 2 geothermal startup pits. These are the tentative waste discharge requirements that are up for adoption today. Next slide, please. So for this presentation, I'll give an overview of the facility history and location. I'll give a very brief, high-level explanation of the geothermal power plant process. I'll provide an overview of the Heber startup pits and their role in the facility. I'll go through the regulatory framework for which this order is being adopted under. I will also discuss the Water Board's authority and their regulatory role when it comes to geothermal power plants. Finally, we did receive comments during our comment period, so I'll be addressing those as well as staff responses to comments. Next slide, please. The tentative order covers Heber 1 and Heber 2 geothermal startup pits. They'll be referred to interchangeably as the facility or facilities. The image on the left shows the general location of the facilities within the Imperial Valley. Imperial County has designated portions of the valley, and they are referred to as the Imperial Renewable Energy Overlay Zone. And this facility is located within that zone. The facilities are owned and operated by Ormat Nevada Incorporated, and they are referred to as the dischargers. Exploration for oil and gas began in the 1960s. In 1972, exploratory wells did confirm the existence of a geothermal reservoir. In 1985, the first Ormat Nevada geothermal plant was commissioned. Both of the startup pits discussed in this order are, they were already in place when the land was acquired by the discharger. The startup pits serve as temporary holding areas for geothermal brine. In the image on the right, Heber 2 is a square outlined in red, and that contains the inactive Heber 2 geothermal startup pit. On the right, we have the Heber 1 triangle-shaped parcel outlined in red, and that holds the active Heber 1 geothermal startup pit. Next slide, thank you. So both plants operate as a binary cycle system to make geothermal power. The photo on the left shows a portion of the power plant at the facility. The photo on the right shows the general process for a binary cycle system. Starting at the bottom at number one, hot geothermal fluid is pumped from the geothermal zone and led to the heat exchangers seen at number two. At number two, the heat warms a secondary fluid, and this creates a steam or a vapor. The vapor at number three then turns a turbine, which generates electricity. At number four, the vapor is then cooled and then turned back into a liquid, and if needed, the liquid would be stored in the startup pits. Finally, number five, the cooled geothermal liquid is pumped back into the reservoir, and this is to maintain its sustainability. Next slide. So this slide shows the Heber 1 startup pit on the left and the Heber 2 startup pit on the right. Both startup pits are rectangular in-ground basins lined with concrete. Each pit is approximately 95 feet long, 70 feet wide, 4 feet deep, and they have a maximum capacity of about 198,000 gallons each. The Heber 1 startup pit is active. Referring to the previous slide, this would be where they would temporarily store geothermal and organic liquids prior to reinjection into the reservoir. But other functions include holding excess brine during system stabilization, managing liquids during operational upsets, and supporting chemical treatments and monitoring activities. As you can see by the photo, Heber 2 startup pit is currently dry. During a staff inspection in 2025, staff observed that the discharge pipeline leading to the pit had been capped. Because the pit is no longer in use, the tentative order requires the discharger to submit and implement a closure plan specifically for Heber 2 startup pit within 180 days of closure plan approval following adoption of this order. These units are regulated as surface impoundments under Title 27. Next slide, please. In this slide, I'm going to be going over the regulatory framework. So the Heber 2 startup pits are two surface impoundment type waste management units. The purpose of this order is to ensure that these units continue to operate safely and in compliance with waste discharge requirements. The tentative order includes several operational requirements designed to protect water quality. First, following the left side of bullet points, we are requiring the discharger to maintain adequate freeboard, so this includes 2 feet of freeboard. The order also limits the facility to only accepting authorized discharges. The facility is also required to maintain the discharge pipeline, make sure that's maintained to prevent any leaks or failures. In addition, the units must be equipped with float sensors, and this ensures that the unit itself isn't overfilled. The discharger must conduct routine inspections to confirm that the structural integrity of each unit is maintained. On the right, following or beyond day-to-day operations, the tentative order also addresses long-term management of these units. The discharger is required to submit a closure plan for the units and provide financial assurances. The financial assurances must be sufficient to cover both the closure activities themselves and any necessary corrective actions should a release occur from the units. The discharger is also required to install a groundwater monitoring network. Next slide. I wanted to clarify the Water Board's authority and the regulatory role when it comes to geothermal power plants. The startup pits or other similar basins that store geothermal startup pits or store geothermal brine are regulated by the Water Board under Title 27 as surface impoundments. However, we don't have jurisdiction over the geothermal wells associated with this facility. So that would include geothermal oversight of all geothermal well activities, such as the volume of geothermal fluid that's reinjected back into the reservoir. We don't cover well locations, leak detection, and leak inspection of these wells. These activities fall under the responsibility of the California Department of Conservation's Geologic Energy Management Unit. We refer to it as CalGEM. We also do not regulate the geothermal reservoir itself. Next slide, please. The tentative order was distributed for public comments. That started April 16th. It ended May 18th. We did receive comments from Ormat Nevada Incorporated. The discharger submitted two main requests. First, the discharger requested to reduce the reporting frequency from two semi-annual reports to one annual report. Staff reviewed this request, and they agree that one annual report is sufficient. The tentative order has been revised to reflect this change. Second, the discharger requested clarification regarding financial assurances, and they did ask to only send financial assurances 180 days prior to the closure of unit. However, under Title 27, dischargers are required to maintain financial assurances, not only for closure, but also for potential releases that could occur from the unit during its operating life. These financial assurance instruments must be updated annually to account for inflation and any changes in the closure and corrective action cost estimates. Therefore, the tentative order retains the requirement for ongoing financial assurances. Next slide, please. The revised tentative order has been distributed to board members and interested parties and includes all changes in response to comments included in this presentation. Staff's recommendation is to adopt the revised tentative order for Heber 1 and Heber 2 geothermal startup pits today on June 9th, 2026. Next slide, please. Thank you for your time. That concludes my presentation. I will take any questions from the board.
Thank you. Do we have any board members with questions or comments?
I have one.
Okay.
Does any coordination take place? Is any required? Is any necessary between our staff and CalGEM when they're doing these facility inspections and or permitting processes, or are they so far apart that there's no need to coordinate with the respective agencies?
That's a good question, and we have thought about that, but at this time, there really isn't any coordination. If there were to be, say, a leak, like a very large leak from the geothermal well itself or the pipeline that distributes the geothermal fluid to the facility, then of course we would be involved because that would interfere with the just water quality in that area. But other than that, no, we don't really talk about where they're going to be installing wells or really what's going on there. Yeah.
And then the previous...
I will add, under the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act, there are, you know, underground injection control regulatory programs that basically, in order to inject something into the subsurface, there is a procedure that the state board does have some involvement in terms of where waste is injected into the ground. So it's my understanding, this is off the top of my head, but it's usually like an aquifer exemption kind of basis where the state board says, no, this is not being used as a source of drinking water, which is different, my understanding, than a MUN designation. But it basically says, okay, this aquifer, this zone is not used as a drinking water supply to some capacity, which is not the same as a de-designation for our basin plan, but because it's pursuant to the federal act. But the state board does have a limited role in that initial process.
State board, though, not us.
State board, yes. Okay.
And then follow-up question on, not to that, I guess, but so this current order contains conditions to close the unused pond. Was the previous permit just anticipate that that pond was going to be used throughout the life of that permit, or was this closure foreseen, or how come now we have to accommodate the closure of that?
So regarding the previous permit that they had, it didn't really cover the startup pits. And so we are required under Title 27 that discharges are required to show us a plan for closure. Mm. And so that's why we are requiring it in this order. I hope that answers your question. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, like the way that Title 27, and one of the things that we come into or we find with a lot of these older orders is that they don't fully implement the law as it exists. And under Title 27, these prescriptive standards that we're supposed to be implementing, if you build a pond that's supposed to contain waste without letting it leak, then you need to have a plan for how you're going to close it. So before you even propose to construct it, ordinarily, you have to say, we're going to do this to tear it all out, and it's going to cost this much, and you have to set aside money to do that, so that way we don't end up with a landfill or a service impoundment where nobody's, you know, using the facility anymore, so we just have this pond full of liquid waste or something else like that. And so you need to have a plan in place for when you're no longer going to use it. Now, for empty ponds, it may not be as big of a deal from a policy perspective because it's just a lined, you know, a concrete pond. But it is the regulation that we're supposed to be implementing. And so, you know, for, was it Heber 2? Heber 2 that's unused, I think they've capped it off. Mm-hmm. So they have no intention to use it in the near future. And so our position was, well, you got to, you know, start thinking about, like, tearing that thing out or, you know, doing what you need to do to restore to some other use of that area. And in the near future, otherwise you're going to have to start complying with financial assurance requirements.
Oh, so if they finalize the closure plan and, you know, fully decommission it, mm-hmm. they don't need the financial assurances returned to them, or they don't?
Well, they won't have to put aside money.
They won't be bonded or whatever.
In a lockbox to set aside, you know, to keep that on hand for when they have to close it. And when we're talking about closure of a surface impoundment, what we're really doing is we're talking about, you know, you tear out the concrete, test it to make sure it's not contaminated with whatever was, you know, it was being used to store. In this case, it might not be as big of a deal, but you basically take out all the waste contaminated containment materials and all anything else that might be contained residual traces of what was being contained within that pond. And then you send that away and then you're good to go. Some of the board members saw a different surface impoundment when we toured the Topoc facility a few months back. Those were another example of a surface impoundment.
Great. No further questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any additional comments or questions? No? Thank you.
Thank you.
The hearing on agenda item 6 is now closed. May I have a motion on agenda item 6, which is a waste discharge requirement order monitoring and reporting program for Heber 1 and Heber 2 startup pits.
Move to approve.
I'll second.
Madam Clerk, when we have roll call.
Chair Perez?
Aye.
Vice Chair Gonzalez?
Aye.
Board Member Beltran?
Aye.
Board Member Music?
Aye.
Board Member Satin?
Aye.
Board Member Wright?
Aye.
Motion carries.
Thank you.
The board will now move to the information items on today's agenda, items 7 through 10. For agenda item 7, the board will now hear a presentation on the Proposition 4 U.S.-Mexico Border Grant Program funding to address transboundary water pollution by Jennifer Toney with the State Water Board.
Good
Division
morning.
Financial Assistance will be presenting this item. No action will be taken.
All right. Good morning, Chair Perez, Vice Chair Gonzalez, members of the board, and members of the public. My name is Jennifer Toney. I'm a senior engineer in the Division of Financial Assistance at the State Water Resources Control Board. And today I'm here to give you an update on our Proposition 4.
Can we get the volume up a little bit, please?
Oh. Sure. Is that on my end or on your end?
On our end, we can hear you low.
Okay, let's see. Let me see if I can adjust that. Apologies here.
Thank you.
All right, I'm a senior engineer. I'll try and talk louder and let me know if you still
are having much better.
Trouble hearing me. I'm a senior engineer in the Division of Financial Assistance at the State Water Resources Control Board, and I am here to give you an update on our Proposition 4 U.S.-Mexico Border Grant Program and our guidelines. Next slide, please. Today, I am here to cover the following topics. I'm going to go over our funding timeline. I'm going to go through our bond language, a little bit on our guidelines overview, the grant amounts, our application requirements, our scoring, and our fundable list preparation. Next slide, please. So here's our funding process timeline. We did post our draft guidelines on February 2nd. And our public comment period ran from February 2nd through March 13th. When it closed, during this public comment period, we did also have two public workshops that we held, one in Calexico and one in San Diego. When this closed, then we did take our guidelines to the board for adoption. Those were successfully adopted April 21st. So we do have our final guidelines posted on our website, which I have that link at the end of our slides here. So now that we have final guidelines, we can open up our solicitation for applications. This is going to happen this week on June 11th at 8 a.m. And our solicitation for applications is going to run from June 11th through August 31st. During this time period, we're going to host an application workshop on June 24th, and that's going to run from 10 a.m. to 11:30. We have the link for registration for this application workshop also on our program website. And our application workshop is going to help potential applications with how to fill out our FAST application, some helpful tips on those required attachments, and we're going to have a Q&A session so that my team and I can answer any questions that potential applicants can have, may have. After the solicitation closes, we're going to score and rank applications in the fall. We're going to prepare our project funding list also in the fall, and then we're going to start issue funding agreements early in 2027. Next slide, please. So here is an overview of the requirements that came straight out of our bond language, which includes the amount available. We have $46.1 million available to projects for this program. The projects have to address water quality problems arising in California, Mexico, cross-border rivers, and coastal waters. This includes the New River and Tijuana River. We can fund projects in California and in Mexico, but the bond language said that projects in Mexico have to show a documented water quality benefit to California and its residents. The bond language also stated that at least 40% of funds have to be allocated to projects that directly benefit disadvantaged communities or vulnerable populations. Under Prop 4, a match is not required, but it stated that priority should be given to projects that leverage local funding. So when we talk about scoring, we'll talk about how we leverage the projects that have local funding. Next slide, please. So here's a little bit about the requirements that are in our guidelines, which includes the types of projects that are eligible. We have two types, planning and research, implementation and construction, and then I'll go through the minimum and maximum grant amounts as far as also application requirements, our scoring criteria, and our fundable list process. Next slide, please. So here are our minimum and maximum grant amounts. For our research and planning projects, the minimum grant is $250,000, and the maximum grant per project is $750,000. And we do state that for these types of projects, no more than $3 million will be utilized for planning and research, and that's out of the $46.1 million. For our implementation or construction projects, the minimum grant per project is $2 million, and the maximum is $10 million. However, our deputy director can increase that maximum grant per project by an additional $10 million for a total of $20 million per project. That's after we review all the applications that are submitted, and we've scored them, and we've assessed the project benefits. And if the deputy director does make this determination and exercise the authority to increase up to $20 million, then we have to have appropriate briefings to the board. Next slide, please. So our applications are going to be submitted online through our FAST system. And like I said, our solicitation doesn't open until June 11th at 8 a.m., but interested applicants can go online and register for an account. If you've never used FAST before, you can do that now. We do have videos that will help if you've never used FAST before, so or my team and I are available to help if you run into any issues. And we also have a FAST email that will help you with any issues that you might run into, or a phone number. So and also my contact information is at the end of these slides. So lots of help available if you've never used the FAST system, or if you need help with our application submittal. So our application package consist of basic FAST information, that is information on your basic project, like your scope and project title, latitude, longitude, your total requested grant amount. It's going to be very simple when you log in to do your basic FAST information. The majority of the application and scoring is going to be based on the attachments. So attachments 1, 2, and 3 are your required attachments, and those are templates, and they actually have already been uploaded to our website, so potential applicants can view these already. Attachment 1 is the work plan. That's going to be the technical information on your project. Attachment 2 is the budget. Attachment 3 is the schedule and scope of work. And this is the information that, if you're selected for funding, that's going to go into the finance agreement. And these are all items that we're going to cover in that application webinar. We're going to give you some helpful tips on how to fill these out. Attachment 4 and 5 are optional. 4 is letters of support or agreements with other agencies that you might have to implement the project. Attachment 5 is any technical documents, such as environmental documents or any plans and specs if you have them. These come into play when we get into scoring. You can get additional points if you have these documents in the scoring. It'll make a little more sense when I get into the scoring in my subsequent slides. Next slide, please. So our scoring criteria, the base score is your project score, and that's based on your resource or impact, or like I like to say, your project type. We have 4 different types: water quality improvement, infrastructure improvement, habitat restoration, planning and research. There's definitions in Appendix C of our guidelines for these types. In the interest of time, I won't give you read them off, but happy to help any potential applicants with where they fall in these categories. And then based on those, there's a higher score for corrective projects, preventative projects, and improvement projects. And I do have the table, so I think I will go to the next slide, please. And then based on that, after you get that project score, then you can boost your project score and receive more projects if, and these are all optional items. You can get additional points if your project benefits a disadvantaged community, if your project mitigates project public health threats, if your project is mentioned in a binational agreement or a water board adopted implementation strategy, if your project has a longer useful life, if you have identified a source of funding for O&M, if you have a match of at least 5%, again, the match isn't required, but this is how we are leveraging that local funding. And then if you do have environmental documents or plans and specs. Next slide. So here's the tables, and I think it'll make a little more sense if you can see the scoring tables. Here's that base project score with the project types on the left-hand side. And then once you have your project type, then you're scored based on corrective, preventative, or improvement project purpose. Now, corrective means if your project corrects either a water quality standard or a violation. If you eliminate a public health threat, you also can be, you're categorized as a corrective project. For preventative, if you prevent a public health threat or prevent a violation, a water quality violation, you would fall into preventative. And then improvement is pretty much everything else. And for planning or research projects, those planning and research projects I forgot to mention earlier in the slides, those are scored and ranked separately from the implementation projects. Next slide. And then the secondary scores, this is those additional, and like I said, they're optional. These are items that boost that project score. And the secondary score, the max is 10 points. So these are all items, again, that not to worry if you're a potential applicant looking at this score and you don't have all of these, they are optional. Next slide. And then we have the cost effectiveness score. This is kind of where the useful life, the O&M, and that match funding comes in. And again, it's optional, you're not required to have these items. Next slide. And then the readiness score, where we have environmental documents, and the reason why we don't say CEQA is because for the projects that are located in Mexico, they're gonna have the documents that are submitted to the Mexican government. For the projects located in California, you're gonna have the CEQA documents. And then if you have plans and specs, you can get varying points based on the percentage that has been completed. So the total maximum score available is 30 points. And so we will add up, we will score each individual application, and then we will score and rank all the projects. And like I said, the planning and research projects will be scored and ranked separately. Next slide, please. And so our fundable list, once we score and rank the projects, we will create a fundable list. And our guidelines do say that at least one project from each river will be represented in the funding list. And I covered the planning and research projects scored and ranked separately. In the event of a tie and not having enough funds to fund both projects that are tied, we will look at the cumulative water quality impacts and the project benefits in order to determine what project will be funded. The staff prepare the funding list and we submit it to the deputy director, and he or she will review and approve the final funding list, and then we will notify the applicants that they are on the final funding list. The projects that are not selected for funding will be placed on a standby list, and then if additional funds are available, then we will notify those applicants that they will then be moved from the standby list to the funding list. That happens if a project drops out for any reason. Next slide, please. And here's my contact information and the link to our program website. And I now am available to answer any questions.
I have a question. What is the timeline for this proposal?
So the applications solicitation will run from the 11th to August 31st. And so applications need to be in before August 31st at 5 p.m. So we will send out an email to everyone on our email subscription list when the application opens, and then we will send out an email notifying everyone that the applications submittal or applications solicitation will be soon closing. So on our program website, you can subscribe to the U.S.-Mexico border email subscription list. So anyone that hasn't done that, I highly recommend that, because that's the best way to stay up to date on the program.
I'm sorry, I do see that. However, my question was, if the funding agreement starts early 2027, when is the up to what time, what year? 1 year, 2 years?
So how long do they have to implement the program?
Yes.
So we have approximately 6 years, so until 2031.
Thank you.
I got a question maybe for Michael. Do you know anybody in our region that is looking at this or would qualify?
Well, yes, Board Member Wright, we have had several inquiries regarding this potential funding opportunity. We did attend the workshop in Calexico, City of Calexico, where we did have several regional stakeholders express interest, and we remain available to communicate, you know, coordinate with them, but certainly Division of Finance is a good source of information on it. But no, we've seen several interested stakeholders, and I hope to see some, you know, effective project proposals.
All right, good, thanks.
I have a question. What are the reporting requirements for folks, for the grantees?
So if selected for funding, they're required to do quarterly progress reports along with their disbursement requests, and then at the end of the project, they have to submit a quarterly or a final project report.
And can you share where, through these quarterly and the final report, that's when staff is getting all the details on progress. Where can the general public get updates on that? Like, I was wondering if maybe in the timeline or scope of work that they submitted, are you weighing them higher if they have public meetings to share progress or milestones, or is that just not something you're looking at?
I mean, we're always happy to share information with the public. But as far as posting it online, that isn't something that we've thought about, but we're happy to think about that as far as how to get that additional information out.
Yeah, I was just thinking about that because I know, like, there will be a lot of eyes on who gets funded, especially mm-hmm. in the Calexico area. So I'm sure community there would like to be in the loop of where's the progress being made on the projects that were funded.
Yeah, I mean, typically we post a list of funded projects, but as far as status updates, yeah, we can think about how we might be able to better relay that to the public once we start awarding.
Those are my questions. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
I have one question, I think. Are there anticipated to be multiple rounds if not all funding is expended on this first series of applications, or is this like a one and done? Whatever is not allocated returns to the general fund or wherever it came from?
Yeah, that's a good question. We're anticipating only one round of funding. I mean, I think since we have $46.1 million, we do anticipate that that will go fairly quickly.
Right. And then just one observation, maybe I understand that we have limited control over our own website, but it seems worthwhile to at least advertise this on our Region 6 page, Region 7, whatever we are, to make sure that folks visiting that can either get to the appropriate application page or know that this funding is even available. Thank you.
Thanks.
Hi, Jennifer. I would just like to say I had the privilege to work with Jennifer at my previous employment, was the High Desert Water District, and she's an outstanding, very smart individual and is an asset to anyone that can use her skills.
Thank you. And, you know, my team and I are available, you know, beyond the application, you know, webinar, if anybody wants to reach out to my team and I for application assistance or help with.
And you mentioned each river. How many rivers are there?
Just the two.
Three?
Two.
Two in our region. Okay.
Board Member Music, this Prop 4 funding is specifically applicable to the Tijuana River in Region 9 and the New River in Region 7.
I have one more question. Is there anything in the language that will prioritize to the agencies that are, or organizations, entities that actually are, that reside and have offices in those areas, like in San Diego, San Isidro, Tijuana, San Diego area, and Imperial County and Mexicali?
There's nothing to prioritize any area over the other. It's just based on the scoring tables that I showed. So it's really about the proposal that the applicants put together. So, you know, we're here to help each applicant with putting those proposals together. So,
any additional questions, comments? Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, agenda item 8, the board will now hear a report from Executive Officer Michael Placencia.
Okay. Good morning, Chair Perez, members of the board, members of the public. I'm Michael Placencia, the executive officer. First, I'd like to thank Jennifer Toney and her staff for preparing and presenting on the Prop 4 Transboundary Water Pollution Funding Opportunities and Guidelines. I hope there will be robust applicants looking to propose beneficial projects to address pollution in the New River. Reminder that the posting for that, the solicitation of applications, is from June 11th through August 11th, and responding to Board Member Satin's request earlier, we'll look into hosting a link to that on our Colorado River website. At our last board meeting on May 12th, we did receive public comments regarding public grant funding that in this particular circumstance was applicable to the Salton Sea. You know, I want to clarify the regional board's role in funding. We support, we can provide technical assistance, collaboration, and even advocacy on projects. However, we have no hand in the appropriation or dispersal of those funds. We direct those questions to the, you know, very capable team at the State Water Board Division of Financial Assistance. And happy to continue to receive questions and comments on that. There's a lot of activity around the sea. currently, and certainly a lot of funding being appropriated and applied there, but the regional board has a specific mandate for protection of ground and surface water quality, and so we are charged with reviewing and permitting discharges, monitoring, and other activities that are not directly associated with funding of those projects. And moving on to the updates, speaking of the New River, unfortunately, sampling at the New River at the international border could not be conducted in April or May due to insufficient funding and access issues, but I'm happy to report that we have plans to resume that sampling this month. Staff did conduct sampling of the species conservation habitats, also referred to as the SCH, located at the south end of the Salton Sea. This data will be used to inform ongoing planning projects, such as beneficial use designation of these habitats. As Board Member Firestone alluded to, a lot is going on at the sea, so I invite anyone interested to look at the Salton Sea Plan annual workshop that was presented to the State Water Board on May 20th. Look that up. It's really informative and quite a robust series of discussions on that subject. In April, staff attended the Colorado River Salinity Forum work group meeting. Participation from other basin states and federal partners convened to discuss the impacts of salinity on the Colorado River and its use. This forum will deliver a 2026 review of water quality standards and new detailed interactive salinity map that will be included in the forum's 2026 triennial review, available later in the year. Regarding recruitments and vacancies, I haven't given you an update in quite some time, so we'll go through some of what's going on here. I have several items to share. Let's see. Two water resource control engineer positions closed last week. One engineering geologist position and one scientific aid position are closing this week. We will be processing applications and proceeding with interviews in the coming weeks. We have posted another water resource control engineer and a position for environmental scientist. Both will be closing at the end of the month or early next month. Finally, our phase one reorg is progressing, and we have posted the position for groundwater protection section supervisor, a senior water resource control engineering opportunity at CalHR, and on our website, with a filing date of July 17th. That could be found through our website on the About Us, and within the About Us link, a drill down on the employment opportunities. I hope to get a strong candidate pool for us to fill this important role. I strongly invite anyone interested to look at these opportunities, learn more about our regional board, and apply. Finally, Madam Chair and members of the board, I'd like to share a personal note about my daughter. Our daughter, Alicia Marie, fantastic young woman, very intelligent, strong, kind, wonderfully stubborn. She's in fifth grade, and today is her advancement ceremony. And I'm not there, right? So I'm here because, you know, the work of this board is important, protecting water quality and surface, groundwater and surface water quality in the region is important. Hosting a forum where we can provide information to the public and stakeholders on Prop 4 funding, addressing water quality and pollution in the New River is important. And anchoring our commitment to these things begins at the top. And so I need to be here. But I did want to take a moment to congratulate her and share with you her accomplishment with honors. Thank you, and this concludes my report.
Thank you.
And Michael, when you talk about these positions that are closing, is the return to work, if the individuals have to show up 4 days a week or whatever, is that going to affect the recruiting, do you think?
I believe that the return to office like most any other circumstances, is a manageable reality of the workplace, of the exciting and challenging opportunities employment with the regional board presents. Naturally, any change is going to introduce, potentially introduce some change to our staff. That executive order went out a year ago, and we're proceeding with the plan to have it go into effect on July 1st. So there are potential impacts from that, certainly, and we'll do our best to manage and recruit through that.
I have a question regarding the permitting for all the restoration projects around the Salton Sea. I know that the California Natural Resources Agency has been prioritizing cutting the green tape, getting these restoration projects through environmental review and permitting process in an expedited manner. Do we have any sort of framework to allow those restoration projects to move through in a faster manner? Do they even rise to that level of needing to be expedited from our perspective? I see legal.
That's an excellent question, and I see our very, very worthwhile counsel reaching for the mic.
For restoration projects, there is already a state water board general order that they can be enrolled under, and under that general order, it actually kind of obviates the need for a lot of the other things that might be required for certain, like ordinary garden variety dredge and fill projects. So, yeah, the enrollment process itself is actually fairly streamlined.
Cool. Awesome. Thank you.
I'll also point out that the newly established Salton Sea Conservancy, a portion of that intent certainly is to bring together parties that would provide for land access that has been one of the factors in how effective previous projects can be. So that's going to be one aspect of that effort to bring that many board members together.
Yeah. Do you have any updates on the ramping up of that agency? I know they've had at least one board meeting. I don't know if they're meeting monthly or if they've got staff positions listed to fill.
Absolutely. The Conservancy is proceeding with staffing up. Currently, CNRA is providing the administrative support. It's my understanding. Certainly, this can be viewed through the Salton Sea Conservancy's website, so you can hear it directly from what was stated at that meeting on May 14th, I believe. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe so. Anyway, so you can hear it directly, but there are concerted efforts to stand that conservancy up, staffing it, beginning with an executive director and all the other supports positions that would be required. Funding has been appropriated and earmarked for that, and so secured for that. So I hope to present more as there is more to present.
Any further questions or comments? No. Thank you very much. We now move to agenda item number 9, board member comments and suggestions for future agenda items. Do any board members have anything they wish to discuss? No? Thank you. Next item is chair's report. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to attend the WQCC due to family crisis. However, we are fortunate enough to have it on. I was able to watch it live on YouTube, which is really nice. Very informative. Okay, Council, are there any matters for discussion in the closed session?
Yes, there are. Pursuant to Government Code 11126, Subdivision A, the board will meet in closed session today to discuss the performance of the executive officer.
Vivian, I got one question.
Sure.
When Laura was talking about a meeting on the 6/16 about ag and nitrate report, could you send us information about that particular meeting? And the one on the 25th, 6/25, what was that one for? Anybody remember?
Wasn't the ag one?
No, the ag one was the 16. Yeah. I think is it like a webinar or something? Is that
about Mono Lake?
The first one was
6/25.
That okay, Mono Lake. Okay, Mono Lake. Okay. Never mind about that. But the 16th, the Ag Nutrient Report. Hey, I'd like to, maybe if I can, I'd like to listen to that.
I'll share that out in a briefing to the board.
Thank you. The next meeting is scheduled for July 14th at 10 a.m. and will be held here at the City of Palm Desert, Riverside County. The public portion of the meeting is concluded. We will adjourn after the closed session. Thank you.